This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Pressure from the outside and imploding from within seems the best way to describe what is happening to the Israeli regime. From growing international pressure by the global civic community to internal political turmoil and a military which has not been able to destroy the resistance but has killed many civilians. That's the reality inside of the Zionist entity. As the military is exhausted and suicide is increasing amongst IOF troops who took a major hit from the Palestinian resistance like the regime had never experienced before. Are we looking at the beginning of the end to the Zionist regime? Well, let's start with the following report.
On the battlefield, the toll has been staggering. Since the start of the Gaza war in early October of 2023, 22,000 wounded soldiers have been treated, with some 58% of them suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, or other mental health conditions. Nearly two-thirds are reservists, many of whom have been called back for repeated tours. Mental health workers reporting record levels of trauma, burnout, and even rising suicide rates.
I think we're going to have a massive wave of suicides that we're not ready to deal with. This is the part that does keep me up at night in a way, because I have no way of knowing if any of my friends are going down that path.
The pressure is also exploding on the home front. A draft bill to conscript more ultra-Orthodox or Haredi men into the army has triggered massive protests and created what analysts describe as one of Israel's biggest internal crises in decades. Only around 1,200 Haredi men reported for service last year, despite 24,000 draft notices. And now new reporting underscores widening cracks between Netanyahu and military leadership. According to Hebrew media, a stormy cabinet meeting saw Netanyahu clash directly with IOF Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir over a proposal to displace Gazans to the south and impose a siege on the north. Zamir pushed back sharply, saying,
"There is no stalemate in the strip. We're doing exactly what you tasked us with, and you don't need to be reminded that we have soldiers dying in battle."
Netanyahu then reportedly demanded the IOF draw up a massive civilian evacuation plan, prompting Zamir to ask,
"Do you want a military government? Who will govern 2 million people?"
Zamir warned the proposal could lead to loss of control over hungry, displaced civilians. Netanyahu is also said to be considering firing War Minister Israel Katz amid disputes over internal military investigation and command authority. Katz and Zamir have openly criticized each other in recent days, prompting Netanyahu to hold separate meetings to contain the turmoil. Israel's aggressions in the region have left tens of thousands of soldiers wounded, with PTSD and suicide risks surging among reservists. On the home turf, attempts to draft more Haredi men have ignited mass protests, deepening societal divides. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu faces escalating clashes with military leaders and infighting among top ministers, exposing fractures at the highest levels of power, with political turmoil, military strain, and social unrest piling up as a repercussions of the two-year genocidal war in Gaza. The future of Netanyahu's leadership and the stability of Israeli regime are hanging in balance.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mohammed Al-Thiq, writer and political analyst out of Ramallah. Ali Hami, military and strategic affairs analyst out of Beirut. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start it off in Ramallah. And Mohammed, the regime doesn't release exact casualty numbers, but estimates put the number of Israeli forces killed in Gaza up to 1,150. Has the regime ever taken such a hit like this since it came into existence?
I think the Israeli regime hides many statistics about these reports. To save at least the morale of the Israeli army. But I think there are many factors made this case inside the Israeli army. The first one, we are talking about the conscription law. When we talk about the conscription law, this law doesn't work inside Israel because of the political contradictions and even the religious principles about Haredim, etc. And we have to talk about the resignations inside the Israeli army with high ranks inside the Israeli army that reflected negatively on the psychological behavior of the Israeli soldiers inside Gaza and who left Gaza for nothing. Not to mention that the Netanyahu's policy that he insisted on about the prolonged war. Netanyahu wanted and insisted on prolonging war to achieve his goals, that at the expense of the Israeli army and the Israeli soldiers. Another factor, we are talking about the bad reputation of the Israeli army. The Israeli army was the invincible army in front of the international community and the Israeli society. Now, the Israeli army became an army pursued legally worldwide. And even you remember the song spread across the Europe and even U.S., death to the IDF. This is right. An important point for the Israeli soldiers, and that reflected negatively on them, not on them, but on them and their families, their neighborhoods. This is a catastrophe for Israel because Netanyahu's policies.
All right, stay with me. Yes, interesting point, Ali, that Mohammed mentioned about the invincibility factor, that that no longer exists. I mean, we're looking at 22,000 troops who were wounded, and this is the statistics that they actually are releasing. Tell me the effect you think that this can have on the psyche of that society, Ali.
Thanks for having me with you tonight.
Thanks for coming.
Let me tell you that I have my own studies, and I published it about 6 months ago via information and resources coming from soldiers and small videos coming out illegally from the Israeli entity. And I end up with 79,000 people suffering from mental illness or disorder. Mm-hmm. 20,000 soldiers being killed within the 2 years, 35,000 injured, including the 22,000 handicapped or disabled within the army. And we can add also the 54,000 soldiers refused to join the army. So we are talking about the Israeli entity army consists of 625,000 soldiers. We are talking about 275,000 reserve, 350 acting in service. So if you we add up all those numbers of losses and casualties, we end up that more than 25% of the Israeli army is fully or totally or partially destroyed. So all what we heard about the Israeli capability right now is coming like slowly to be exposed to public. And I think I missed it by a very small margin of error I have, mm-hmm. because they declared like 83,000 mentally illness or disorder. I figured before, about 6 months ago, it ended up with my calculation, 79,000. So up to now, I'm still waiting for them to confess. About the 35,000 injured, 20,000 soldiers killed. And if you ask me how I ended up with these numbers, I can explain.
Very interesting, very interesting. Well, just tell me a little bit, staying with you, Ali, because as we talked about, that they definitely try to control the information coming out. But you said dealing with various videos that had gotten out from the regime and other information. Am I correct?
Exactly.
All right. Thank you. Going back to Mohammed now, 58% of IOF who were in Gaza now suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. I mean, what does that say to you? Because, if we look at it's really mind-boggling, because if we look at the situation, for example, we saw when we were able to see Hamas earlier, or Al-Qassam brigades in the middle of the war, and you see the mentally the way that they are handling it, even though they have so much pressure. Or if we look on the other side of the border, Lebanon and Hezbollah, and the way that their soldiers have seen the war, and even though they have taken a hit, but it's a very different perspective. But then we have the entity itself that's behind all the chaos, that 58% of their troops at least are suffering from PTSD. I mean, what does that say to you?
From my point of view, I think that means that the soldiers faced the fierce resistance in Gaza, the resilience of the Palestinians, and they hide many stories. They killed kids, they killed families, whole families. They killed children, they killed women. And they stuck. They were stuck in Gaza, by the way. Because of that, I think the resilience and the resistance of the Palestinians reflected negatively on their behavior, reduced their morale, and for nothing, by the way. There is no achievement on the ground. There is no victory on the ground. There is no day after in the ground. And with Netanyahu's policies about a multi-front war, like you said about Lebanon, all soldiers just became a tool in Netanyahu's eyes to use them inside Gaza and then in Lebanon. Then he prepared them to go into Syria for nothing, just to achieve his goals or to serve his personal interests or his coalition. I think Netanyahu and his coalition dealt them a blow, and that reflected negatively on their behavior. They became paralyzed people, and their life now, with the stories from Gaza, with the reaction of the international community against them, we saw many stories for soldiers who traveled to Europe and the US. They faced a huge storm of criticism. And some of them have been subjected to attack from people. Why? Because their reputation is damaged by their behavior and by the Israeli political echelon and their policies.
Okay. Well, Ali, I mean, let's look at the political perspective. There's growing opposition to the Netanyahu cabinet, with many opposition groups saying that he's using the war to push through various controversial reforms and also to keep himself in power. I mean, what's your perspective about this, and how do you see this affecting the overall situation inside of the entity?
With no doubt, we can see that Israel is moving or transferring from the stability and managing the contradiction inside Israel to the war of contradictions. And we see that Yair Lapid, the head of the opposition parties, exposing all the lies of the cabinets now that been declared by Katz or by Benjamin Netanyahu, just to cover their corruption inside Israel for so long. For what we are talking about, more than about 25 years since 1997. And still now, the opposition parties trying to take and drag Netanyahu into jail. And this will generate some kind of disorder and a kind of chaos inside the Israeli entity. But I would like to add something regarding the losses of the, because this is very effective and it has big influence about how the politicians are going into what path inside the Israeli policies. Since I said that 20,000 soldiers being killed since 7th of October, let me tell you one thing only for tonight, because it needs more explanations. When Israel on the 7th of October declared that the Zionist Gaza division totally demolished, totally destroyed, and we know that the division within an army consisting of 625,000 soldiers, it means that a division consisting of three brigades, each brigade should be consisting between 5,000 and 7,000 of 7,500 soldiers. So in this case, let's say 12,000 in service acting, 6,000 in vacations or in recess. So it means Gaza division at the night of, or at the time of 7th of October, at that date exactly, It was 12, the number is 12, was, sorry, 12,000 soldiers in active service. So when Israel declared that all the division were demolished and killed, it means they declared that 12,000 soldiers were killed at that night. The second night, they said, no, only 1,200 soldiers were killed. So they just take zero out of the number. And after 2 years, since they declared on the 7th of October that there was 1,200 soldiers by their calculation or misleading numbers, 1,200 soldiers were killed, to end up after 2 years of fighting that only 1,000, they declared now that only 1,170 soldiers only that being killed during those 2 years. This is a big lie.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that insight. Well, Mohammed, with all these various issues taking place inside of the regime, tell me your thoughts about how the social cohesion of that society is being affected.
Evidently, I think the Israeli policy, or let's be precise in this point, Netanyahu and his coalition wanted to escape from the scene to save their future. But the opposition inside Israel asked Netanyahu today, even they asked them second time today, if you want to take a pardon, you have to leave the political scene. Netanyahu refused that. By the way, he considered that as a society. It's not a big deal for him. He wanted to save his political future, and he wanted to take a pardon. This is a critical point for Netanyahu and for his coalition, by the way. Because of that, I think Netanyahu to save his coalition from collapsing and to save his political future, he wanted to create new obstacles inside the Israeli political scene. With the internal conflict now, I think the opposition will go through another plan, on the contrary of the expectations about the unity, about the government, about the consensus unity, consensus government, sorry. But Netanyahu used to go through obstacles or plots to gain more time and to gain more power to strengthen his coalition or to make a new coalition with the new parties inside Israel. But I think they are in a big dilemma now, and the situation will be worse in the next days, especially about the main issues inside Israel and about the region, especially after the transformations in the region.
Okay, well, Ali, would you say that the genocide in Gaza and the regime's continual aggression in the West Bank and Lebanon, along with its 12-day war with Iran, has greatly cost the regime? And how do you see this affecting the current economic situation inside of Israel?
Also, according to my calculations and to the Israelis and American studies that I could get hold of it, that the Israeli losses economically is over $480 billion. The military spending on war, more than $80 billion. And now we are talking about increasing of defense budget by 3% to be like about 7 to 8% of GNP, which is like about $610 billion a year, the Israeli economy. So we are. They are going into a big dilemma and a recession, or let's say maybe not inflation but deflation also. So the Israelis are suffering right now, and especially exactly after the 12 days war with Iran, because we could saw and hear that the Israelis confess that more than 52% of the, let's say, the factories, and especially I'm talking about the military equipment factories, and also the big generators, I'm talking about big electric stations. We are talking about also the research centers, big research centers, in addition to also Iran had the big, I think it was Nevatim airport, which were consistent of or containing more than 20 F-35 fighter jets. So I don't know if it was damaged or not. But according to those information, we can see that Israel is now under economic pressure. The United States cannot help because they are going into a recession also, maybe slowly, for what's going on around the world and what's going on in the war in between Russia and Ukraine. And also they are trying to invade also Venezuela. We can see that the United States is spreading everywhere, and it's very costly. They cannot assist the Israelis with such big amount. Maybe they can support them with a small amount of money, a few billions, but we are talking about more than $480 billion in debt.
No. All right. Well, Mohammed, do you think that the Zionists are facing a different reality today compared to October of 2023, and as the world is looking at them differently, and increasingly more young Zionists are actually leaving Israel and migrating elsewhere?
Absolutely, yes. Netanyahu's speech today in the Israeli parliament indicates the crisis that he lives. And I think Netanyahu wanted now to go through the relations with the international community. By the way, he launched a campaign to fix and to renovate the image of Israel, to renovate his image at least among the leaders of the international community. And he bragged about many things about Iran, about Lebanon, about the West Bank, about Gaza, the Gaza Strip. But when you go to see the reality, there is nothing. There is nothing on the ground. There is no achievement. Netanyahu misled the international community, misled the Israeli society. The Israeli society asked about investment, asked about stability, asked about prosperity, asked about the day after in Tel Aviv to see the calm situation. But till now, Netanyahu insisted on creating more wars, launching more wars, and he talked about a multi-front war.
Okay.
Netanyahu mentioned Putin to save the border of Israel. That means he is in a big dilemma now to talk with Russia or to talk with the U.S. At least he wanted to gain more power in front of the opposition.
All right. Stay with me, Mohammed. So sorry, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much. So sorry we're out of time. Mohammed Al-Qiq, a writer and political analyst out of Ramallah, Ali Hami, military and strategic affairs analyst out of Beirut. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Asma. I have the honor to be your host once more, and you are listening to Muslim Lady. This is the cozy corner for all the ladies out there. Wherever you are, I hope you're doing just well. So, as usual, we have our very dear lady to help us with the insights, and she is Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming here.
I am Tarfadlan Zainab Askari. I'm actually from Kashmir, and I've been studying Hausa here for the last 10 years, and I'm also authoring one or two books on Muslim lady.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for coming here and for cooperating. So we have many narrations, many numerous narrations, encouraging the families to go for the proposers who actually have got the best manners and they are religious people. I would ask you a personal question. Imagine for your future girl, there comes a proposer. One of them, one of the proposers, is wealthy, yet you're not sure about their religion. The other one is actually not wealthy, but very religious. And when I say religious, don't take that literal, because sometimes religiosity does not show on your appearance. And it is in the way you act.
In your conduct.
Yeah, in your conduct, actually. Which one would you rather to pick for your daughter or encourage her to go for that one?
Of course, what Lady Khadija salamu alayha did. She was a business tycoon herself. And
she was already wealthy.
Yeah, she was already wealthy and she always had wealthy suitors for her.
Exactly.
But then the one she chose was because of the religion and not... Again, on the apparent basis, but in his conduct during the business trip they had and the way she saw, like, how faithful.
Faithful, yeah.
Yeah, so, sometimes.
Her criterion was actually the trustworthiness of the prophet.
Yes. So, yeah, definitely, like, if I was at that place, I would definitely, like, if today we have the same situation, I would... definitely go with the same thing. Like, I remember, yeah. Even like when my husband's family came as suitors for me, we had many people before that, and like some were like working in the UAE, some were working in other Middle Eastern countries, and this was not the first one like who was studying abroad or something. Like,
yeah.
They were like quite wealthy than him.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that my father liked was... Well, my father was standing at the door and his sister, she said, Ya Allah, like rather than telling him, like, excuse me, can you go get aside or I want to get inside. And my father was really impressed with this. And he said, like, did you notice, like, she didn't talk to me. She didn't tell me, can you get aside, excuse me or something. And the beautiful thing she said, Ya Allah, and how, you know, spiritual our home became by this Ya Allah and how spiritual this marriage
yeah.
can be. And a lot of things like later on, like, when he saw my husband for the first time, they went outside together and then they were driving and he stops at one of the roads and then he picks up the stone, keeps it aside while he had already crossed the road. And my father was like, see, like we had crossed, but yet like so that others do not get into trouble. I'm like, I am okay with this person. I know that they are not much financially.
But do you think that everybody is like, I just want to be more realistic. Like in today's world,
yeah.
for girls... If they are given the choice of the wealthy man who is not religious apparently and then
okay.
the other man who is religious yet unwealthy,
yeah.
they wouldn't...
Which is very common, actually.
Yeah, which is very common. They wouldn't actually go for the religious one. And then they would tell you, why do we have to care for religiosity? I
yeah.
want to clarify this point that... Why spirituality of a person, why the religiosity of a person is very important?
It is the basic criterion to choose a spouse in Islamic teachings. Like, according to the Holy Quran, the most important criterion for a suitable spouse is faith. And there are so many other things, like, you know, there are so many other criteria, like how much importance they give to the acts of worship, what is the family background and the righteous friends. Friends are very important. Like, it's also seen, like, what kind of friends he hangs out with. And also, they should have appropriate dress, appropriate character, modest. Modesty, where does that modesty, where does your dressing sense, it comes from the religion. And all the differences I think people have over is the religion things.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear ladies. I hope you're still following us and the insights Sister Zainab is sharing with us about the topic of marrying the one who is already a religious man and not necessarily a wealthy man, apparently, by the way. So you're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma, and Sister Zainab is here, and she's talking about the fact that religiosity and the spirituality of a man is all that a woman must search for.
Because the religion gives you the path, and because of religion you are able to decide, like, when you wake up, when you sleep, how you wake up, how you sleep.
It gives you a conduct book.
Complete conduct book.
Yeah. So for the question I asked, for the girl who comes to you and then tells you, why do I have to care for religiosity of a man? Isn't humanity enough?
I would say the...
Because, you know, in today's world, in the modern world, we have this religion of humanity.
Yeah, unfortunately. Because I think the goal has been just this world. Like, it's important to take blessings from this world and use them and to work and to, you know, provide sustenance for your family. Everything is important. But this world should not be the ultimate goal. Those who look at this world as an ultimate goal, they get stuck. For example, it said that, it's a beautiful story, it said that there was a man who fell in a well, but he holds a rope. And down in the well, there's a big snake whose mouth is open. And above the well, there are two mouses, black and white, and they are trying to cut the rope. And now he's confused, and all of a sudden he sees the honey on the side of a well, and he gets, he gets distracted with the honey. And this is dunya. This is the world. This is attractions of the world. This is that humanity. This is that wealthiness and all. The black and white masses represent the day and night. And this rope is your life.
Exactly.
And the snake, with open mouth down in the well, is the grave, right? So this should not be forgotten. Like, our ultimate destiny is somewhere else. What I have to take there, like, how much wealth I will
be. Do not be distracted by the honey.
Yeah.
And because eventually you're going to end up in that snake's mouth.
And I think the more the religion makes you human, the humanity itself won't be able to make you more human. So, like, religion is all about humanity.
And we have to note that humanity has got some borders, and to some extent it might be selfish at some points because it is humanity. But religion does not have any selfishness in itself.
Right. And it does not contradict with humanity at, like, many stages.
It includes humanity, but humanity in itself may not include religiosity and spirituality.
Exactly. So this makes it quite important. And I would also say, like, why is it important? Like, for example, since the culture we come from, for example, you might have known that India is a country which has got most of the religions of the world.
Yeah.
Right? So there are so many interfaith marriages there. We witnessed that. I personally come from Kashmir. And in Kashmir, we have like 90% of Muslims. For example, Allah conquers all up to when? Like, if you have... if you try to go through it, like, very, very positively, still, till the moment you have a child, then the naming of a child, then rearing a child.
Upbringing of the child.
Exactly. Like, we witnessed. And then, like, when my mother's friend used to say this very beautiful thing, and this is so true, I would like to quote her. She would say that, and I was once talking to her on phone, and I was like, What happens to that love concourse of things, and why does that love disappear after?
It has a limit.
After things start, you know, showing themselves up, after like people face realistic things in their lives. And she was like, love before marriage is exactly like the soda water. There are these beautiful bubbles and that pop up.
Well, that's a very beautiful analogy.
Yeah. And those bubbles do pop up once they are into the marriage. So don't think about what happened to that love that was not love, that was a soda water. And literally it is. We have seen that. So before this, you know, before you're getting for inter-community marriage or interfaith marriage, you should definitely see that. Is that a soda water or something like that? Because everything starts with your gaze. And in Quran, we have been told, lower your gaze. First to men and then to believing women. They are told to cover themselves in a way. And if that thing is practiced, actually, you know, nothing like that, the love before marriage would appear. And actual love happens basically after marriage.
Until there would be no persistent temptation, like, to get into something that you shouldn't get into.
Yeah, because, like, before that, people try to show you only the best version of themselves. They would never tell you where do they, how unorganized they are. They would never show you where do they throw their socks when they come home. They would never show you any other, you know, all those flaws they
carry.
The
unmasked version of themselves.
Exactly.
Like us human beings, we have many masks on our faces.
Mm-hmm.
But these masks are going to be put off of our face.
Yeah.
Right at the moment when we get into the same house, the same room, like having constant interaction with each other, that would be once I little by little start to mask off.
Exactly. And if that pops up like that bubble, it's as Shakespeare says, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds.
Exactly. Very true. Religiosity is important even for those people who do not believe that religion is an important factor. Why? Because those who believe in a religion, they've got a God who believe that he's watching over them. And since that Almighty is watching over them, they would be very careful of and cautious of every single step they take. So the person who's already aware of an Almighty is technically more trustworthy than the one who does not believe in any other, in any actually superpower, in any Almighty.
Right.
So these guys would be pretty much more human in the sense of humanity. Like they would be caring more for humanity because these are the precious creatures of God. They would take more care of you as their spouses. So yes, thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, dear ladies. This was all the time that we had for today. I hope you have enjoyed that. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Ancient city of Hafshadon is a good place for archaeology enthusiasts to pay a visit. According to the findings of the excavations that have taken place in some of these old mountains, people have been living in this area for about 9,000 years. And so the city of Hafshadon is considered to be one of the first settlements of the New Stone Age. The city of Hafshadon, also known as the city of industrialists, is in the southwest of Iran, 12 kilometers from the city of Shahrekor. Hafshadon is in the second largest valley of the province of Charmahal Bakhtiari at the foot of the beautiful Jahanbin Mountain.
According to the locals, the city of Hafshajan has an invaluable heritage left behind from lost civilizations. And to see these historical treasures, we're heading towards the Jahanbin Mountain. Our Hafshajani friends told us that we had 2 hours worth of hard hiking ahead of us. So we decided to make a quick stop at a nearby spring and fill our bottles with its fresh and cool water before heading out again. No pain, no gain, I suppose. Every single time we felt we'd had enough, the thought of what we were going to see once we arrived kept us moving until we finally reached the Ganavishte inscription. Unfortunately, because of the ever-changing climate, the scorching hot sun and the freezing snow, the symbols are mostly gone. Happy that we got to see an ancient relic before it was totally destroyed, we headed towards our next destination, a place said to be nature's playground, the Shah Mansar Mountain. On our way up to the Shah Mansar Mountain, we were promised that we'd be able to see some of the most amazing views Hafshajan has to offer. And they were right. Nature is amazing. And playful at times. If you look over there, next to each other, you'll be able to see 2 figures. One could be an elephant and one a buffalo. I'm sure that if you use your imagination and look all over this place, you'll be able to find many more. Let your imagination run wild. That's what we were told. If we had gone further up the mountain, we would have definitely seen more of nature's artistry. But you would have had to have the eye and the heart for it. Feel the force around you, so to say. And the last but not least location we'll pay a visit to is the Iskandari Hill in Hafshajan. This is the first and largest national historical site in the province of Charmahol Bakhtiari. Based on the remnants of pottery that were discovered on this site and around it, it is estimated that it dates back to about 9,000 years ago and probably had a structural form similar to a ziggurat. This is the end of our journey, but there is still so much more to be seen. I guess we'll leave the rest to you. This is Gulnar Farnoodi for Iran. Why do most objects made from clay touch us so deeply? What's so special about them? Why is a jar, a plate, a pot, or even this little fish made from clay so evocative? Well, for starters, they're made from the essence of life, fire, earth, and water. You see, this is life itself, and I can feel her little heart beating.
A ceramic workshop belonging to a friend was probably the best place I could learn more about the art of ceramics. A 2-story working studio that throws you into the land of pottery, where all is plates, platters, dishes, bowls, jars and mugs made from clay. I call them artworks and handmade treasures. Excavations show that the art of pottery dates back to the 7th and 8th millennium BC in Iran. As time went on and techniques improved, this art form reached new heights and masterpieces were created. The masterful brushstrokes of the Iranians on the ceramic works were the true narrators of the people's stories, their culture, customs, way of life, taste, talents, religious beliefs, and of course, their prayers. Azadeh wanted to draw more attention to the art of ceramics, and so she decided to bring various artists together to paint on a ceramic plate. In the exhibition, around 250 artists took part, each displaying their own unique ceramic plate. The event was warmly received by the people. It was very interesting to see how a simple ceramic plate could produce an endless possibility of designs and forms that reflected the emotions of its creator. Each plate was unique and amazing because as you stood there watching the brushstrokes, you could hear it whispering, telling you little secrets of the artist that brought it to life. Let me tell you something interesting. Each artist was given one and only one plate to paint on. Sounds challenging. Well, they all took up the challenge and created their own unique ceramic painting that told their own story. A challenging experience, but at the same time, intriguing. Working with clay, with the elements of life, must surely be enjoyable. And life's all about that. After all, as Omar Khayyam, Iran's prominent poet, puts it, "And strange to tell, among the earthen lot, some could articulate while others not. And suddenly, one more impatient cried, 'Who is the potter, pray, and who the pot?'" Hoda Lezgi for Iran.